The Guardian.
In this Guardian podcast brought to you by RNIB, actor Christopher Eccleston narrates Now That You've Died, a short story written by Patrick Ness, especially for Read for RNIB Day, a campaign which aims to open up a world of reading for blind and partially sighted people.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
This is a big week for the award-winning novelist Patrick Ness. His first novel is being reissued, his latest one is just out in paperback, and a new edition of his 2005 short story collection, Topics About Which I Know Nothing, is being republished with a brand new short story. It's read here exclusively for the Guardian Books podcast by former Doctor Who Christopher Eccleston.
Here. Take. Eat. This will not sate your hunger. Nothing can when you're dead. That is what death is. A state of constant hunger for the things you've left behind, for your memories, for life. This is why we cannot allow you to return until your death is fully complete. If even then. But eat. Taste. Try. These are the fruits of your sins. Are they bitter? Are they sweet? Are they bittersweet? Taste your regret. Taste your guilt. Taste your longing. And forget. Forget when you were tactless or cruel. Forget when you were selfish or ungenerous or mean. Forget when you raged or you criticized or you belittled. Forget when you gave in to your momentary longing that time in Swindon, because you were so attentive to your wife after, so much more caring, so much more loving, that you convinced yourself that it hadn't been a sin at all, that it had been a good thing. Then forget the sin of self-deception. Forget when you shoplifted the Mars bar from the off-license. Forget when you found the wallet in the car park and returned it to its owner, claiming the money was already gone when you picked it up. Forget all the joy and happy hours you stole from your favoured younger sister out of jealousy and self-hate. Forget the jealousy. And please, please, forget the self-hate. Even though the taste is harsh, eat and forget. For sin is only another word for the harm you've done to yourselves. And you've done so much harm. You have taken the unfathomable gift of life given to you by a universe you cannot even begin to interpret, and you have used it as occasion to worry, to suffer. You have found ways to squander even unbounded riches and plenty. You have brought untold war and death on each other. Every system of government you have ever devised has... But no. No. Now is not the time for judgment. Not yet. Nor are we those who will pass it. You will do that yourselves, and you will not count it as a blessing. But first, you must finish dying. As much as we might wish to cut your burdens from you, we cannot. You must do that yourselves. Who were you? What do you hold on to? Love? Yes. Love. Always love. How you went on about it, and you were right to do so. As an emollient, as a pleasure, as a meaning in an existential universe, love takes some beating. But it's the thing that attaches your previous lives to you the most. Love is the stickiest glue, and it will trap you here, which is a situation you would not like. Fortunately, we have made it easier for you. The food you ate. Your sins. They were poisoned. Poisoned with forgetfulness. Do not complain. We do not listen to complaints. These swords, this armour, these teeth, they are not the accoutrements of ones who are amenable to complaint. You must forget. You must. It is the only way. You are forgetting now. Can you not feel the burden of your lives falling away? All the unnecessary attachments, all the loves that broke your heart, all the passions that seem so important for those few fleeting moments. What do you mean, no? Do not be stubborn. We shall not abide stubbornness. You are forgetting the girl who let her slightly crooked teeth get in the way of seeing herself beautiful until you did it first. Feel her fade. Let her go. Her with the laugh that caused restaurants to fall silent. Her with the shoe size she always lied about. Her who you loved so deeply there were actual physical changes to your heart rate, your blood pressure when she walked into the room. She who mourns you now. You must let her go. Yes, you must. And you, hiding in the middle of the others, hoping it would escape her attention that you ate nothing for fear of this exact thing happening, you must forget the boy with the lopsided smile, who never sneezed once but always 8 or 9 times in quick succession, and who you taught how to drive, and whose forearms were always such a source of daydreamed pleasure. Cast him off. Set him adrift. Be free of him. And you there, with the thoughts of your twin sons, and you, sir, still suffering with unrequited love for your postman, all of you, with your lovers and partners and friends and sisters and children and pets, quite a lot of pets, actually. But you must let them go. If you do not, the rest of this journey will be harder than you can bear. You will go astray. You will be lost. We will give you a moment to say goodbye to all that you loved. Ready? Have you set down your memories? Have you said a final goodbye to your loves and your losses and your sins? If so, then we shall proceed. If not, we shall proceed regardless, though we cannot be responsible for what might happen to you. For now, we approach the most dangerous part of the journey. A part which has seeped into your beliefs about death. A part a good portion of you are expecting, and frankly, the portion of you that aren't expecting this are the ones who should be expecting it the most. We approach the fire. The same fire that set our swords ablaze. The fire that scours the slate with white ash. The fire that burns away the rust you've let accumulate on your soul. For you have been mistaken all your lives. Fire does not destroy. Fire changes. Are you ready to be changed?
We're sorry you're frightened. But you have no choice. You must continue. You ate more than your fair share just now, and we did not have enough to feed the ever hungrier dead who follow you. If you stay behind, you will be consumed.
But you will not stay behind. We carry swords for a reason. For example, you there, where do you think you're going? Yes.
That is now one fewer of you who will continue this journey. Do not ask what happens when you are felled by our swords.
You do not wish to know. Now, onwards. Afraid of the fire. If you have left behind all that you were, you have nothing to fear. If you are an empty soul, ready for the kiln, you will feel nothing but the purest pleasure, a sensation like a warm bath, except on fire. You will pass through and re-emerge a lighter being. You will be relieved of the last of your connection to time. You will know a cleanliness like you have never experienced, not on your soiled earth, not with your soiled lives. Again, apologies. We are not here to judge. But consider the word clean for a moment. Do you know it? There are at least three obsessive compulsives among you who claim to know it, but none of you have even the slightest idea. Even when you washed your bodies, even when you soaked them in luxurious baths that could have watered the crops of an entire drought-stricken village, even then you were left crawling with colonies of uncountable bacteria under your fingernails, living in your gut, roosting in their thousands on your very eyelashes. And those of you who would clean your minds with logic and reason, with piety and good works, how much more numerous were the bacteria that infested your nooks and crannies? What prejudices did you hide? What diseases of personality did you hope no one would ever discover about you lest they bring them to light? You strove for cleanliness while standing in mud. You dared to reach for the divine while...
One moment. Yeah, yes, all right. Fine, fine, I said. We said. Yes, I'm going to tell him. Will you just... Yes, okay, whatever. You were also capable of great works of art and literature, of love and compassion and kindness, of generosity and bravery, of curiosity and reason and faith and joy and tenderness and exaltation and commitment and mercy and flirtation and pity and justice and humour and beauty and gentleness and care and punctuality. And not killing anyone. Except you, sir. We have an eye on you. And being nice to cows. And paying your TV licence. And watching BBC Four. And separating out your recyclables. And slowly walking 10 kilometres to raise £130.45 for lupus. Yes, yes, you were capable of wonders. Yes, all right. Happy?
You will still burn.
This way, please. Over here. Come along. Well, if you've read your guidebooks and followed all instructions, you have nothing to fear. Calm yourselves. The fire is already beneath your feet. It already rises up what you persist in thinking of as your skin. You should feel the ease start to take you. What do you mean it hurts? Well, how can it? If you did everything we asked of you, you have no bodies to be injured, no nerves to alert yourself to pain. How can you... Unless... Unless, of course, you were unable to leave yourselves behind, weren't you? You were unable to set aside your loves and your transgressions. You still cling to the memories and grievings of your former lives. You stubbornly look death itself in the face and say, no, this I will not give up. This I will not let go. You do. Yes, you do. We hear you.
You then. You bow your head in false humility while clinging on to the day you watch your daughter graduate from Cambridge with a first in economics, 4 months before she was drowned in a river. You will not let it go, the happiness. You hope to meet her here, and you will not let her go. And you, with the wife you loved for 41 years, who died and left you on your own for another intolerable 11, you refuse to relinquish the smell of lavender with which she used to dab her pillow. Even when all other memories faded during your long, slow, interminable death, you clung to that, an oasis in a desert, and you are damned if you are going to let it go now. Now, when you may have a chance to see her again. Well, sir, you are correct. You are damned. You, the little boy lost to neglect, who does not know how to set aside his hope that this is a better place, that this is where Mummy and Daddy came on those long hours they left you alone, the hope that you must find them here soon, if only we could all get to where we are going, if only the terrible, terrible men with the burning swords and the claws and the great black wings unfurled with the sufferings of millions, because, oh yes, the young among you can see us in their minds all too well. They have not yet learned to ignore the reality of their imaginings. And they think if only these great giant men with their gnashing teeth and stitched over eyes would show us the way out, the way through. But that is impossible. You have refused your duty. You have refused your instruction. You will not forget yourselves. The flames engulf you and burn you away. You have provided them all the fuel they could wish for. They are the flames of the still hungry dead, and they consume you. You burn. You feed the fire until there is nothing left of you, and you are utterly, hopelessly, eternally...
lost.
But not. Are you still with us? Most of you are. Most, but not all. The mother found her drowned daughter. The husband found his wife. The matador found his bull. If you listen, you may hear them weeping together. They'll all come along, in time. When they're ready to put down their swords they've just picked up, someone has to protect the rest of you from the hungry dead. And who better than the dead who've been sated? But now, come. Those who remain, you're nearly there. You've died and died again. Congratulations and welcome. What did you hold on to? You were willing to let some things slip away voluntarily, through forgetting, through the fire itself, but you also defied us. You defied both the darkness and the flames. You defied our swords and our threats. You defied judgment itself to hold on to your most precious thing, which is, of course, the thing that makes you who you are. What did you hold on to beyond the last moment? What was it that not even death could take from you? But you do not have to tell us. It is written on your souls, and will always be. You will take it with you from this place. You will not be able to read it yourselves, for we can never look at our own souls lest the magnitude kill us. But it is there, forever. And it will dictate your next shape. So, we hope it was love. Even we, with our swords, the dead who stayed, we hope it was love. We hope it was not sorrow, but if it was, you will have this chance again. When we hope a better word may be written. You are what you remember. You are what you hold on to. And it is time to take that thing and go. The door awaits. What's beyond it, you ask? Another life? Another world? Another kind of place altogether? Even we do not know and will not find out until we are ready to enter it ourselves. We only know that most of you will return here, again and again, writing your most important words on your souls until they are at last full and ready. Hold them tightly. The time is here. The time is now. Do not be frightened. You've come through fire. We could not harm you now. Take that which even death could not make you relinquish. Take what is best of yourselves, hold it close, and be reborn.
That was Now That You've Died, read by Christopher Eccleston. Patrick Ness is with me here in the studio. And Patrick, I said at the beginning that it was read by Christopher. Strictly speaking, that's not accurate, is it? It reads almost like an oratorio to me.
The story was commissioned by the RNIB as part of a Read for RNIB Day, which is a day that they use to raise funds and awareness about how blind and partially sighted people have access to a fraction of the books that the rest of us do. And they said, would you write a story for us that we could read, that we could turn into a kind of a performance without sight as a sense? And I thought that was fascinating. It's fascinating. And I said, well, instead of just a story, why don't we make it, like, as you said, like an oratorio? And so I wrote this story, and they turned it into this fantastic, immersive theater production where you would hear Christopher's voice as you descended after your death into this horrible, terrible, bureaucracy after death of the things you have to leave behind. And, you would get into this fantastic, they constructed a fake elevator car that looked exactly like one, and the lights would go out and you'd be, turned around. And people were quite scared at it, which was great. It was some people from Punch Drunk and some other people, and it was the best kind of immersive theater, and I loved it. It was such a great experience. So yeah, I would say a performance.
And one of the interesting things is how it fits together with what was the last story, The Gifted, which is, reminds me of Ishiguro's Never Let Me Go. It's about a group of gifted kids and it's a very sinister story in which deaths occur, and then suddenly you're into this oratorio. I wondered whether you had a sense of that shape when you did this last one.
Oh gosh, no, probably happy accident. I mean, The Gifted is interesting because it's one of the very few pieces of autobiographical writing that I've ever done. I mean, I'm up to an obvious point. There were no massive deaths in my fifth and sixth grade class, but it is a story about being the weird gifted outsider in a terribly well-intentioned but bad idea of a gifted class in the poorest school in the school district, which should have worked, really didn't, and was it interesting to be the groundbreaker there.
And it's got a very sci-fi edge. And you're, of course, known now for your young adult fiction, which includes the Chaos Walking trilogy. So I'm very interested in the roots of it are absolutely here, aren't they?
I don't know. I think we live now in an age where genres leak. And I think age groups leak as well. And I'm very, very happy about that. And I've always been a really strong proponent of I will write what I like. Tell somebody telling me what to write for a good reason or for a bad reason or whatever. I want to be the one who chooses. I want to be the one who gets to say, this is my palette. And I will take elements of this and elements of that. And so hopefully it's more an early showing of the way I like to make genres leak together. Because that's fun. And that's how people read today.
You're almost being rebranded as an adult author, because the first novel that I mentioned at the beginning, The Crash of Hennington, is an adult novel. This is a short story collection for adults, although I imagine your teen readership will come to it with you.
Why would you not want to take the risk? Why would you want to allow yourself to be pigeonholed? And I mean, I can't comment on how things have worked out or not for other people. I can comment possibly on the dilettantism of lots of adult writers thinking children's books are easy. But and you know, falling flat on their faces, the Theodore Boone kid lawyer, for example. But, you know, I started in adult novels. Writing Chaos Walking was a surprise. I didn't expect to write a teen novel. I had an idea that revealed itself to be a teen novel, to which I said, great, let's see where it goes. But to me, I put in the same commitment, the same effort, hopefully the same emotional investment. And if I like them, I don't see why anybody else couldn't read both. So I don't know. I think it's more, I'm not asking, I think it's more like, I think in a way it's not asking permission. I'm not asking anyone, is this okay that I do this? I'm just saying, here's the next thing. This is what it is. And the next thing after that might be something different. And I don't know, that approach has worked for me.
I think you're being a bit coy about the differences between young adult and adult fiction, aren't you? I mean, you have to be more direct with young adult fiction. They tend to have more cheerful trajectories. There are all sorts of things.
I mean, aren't YA there? Have you been reading? You don't have to do anything in YA. You don't have to do anything in an adult book. I mean, writing for teenagers, there is a tendency to need a narrative that works, but it is a mistake, and it's a mistake that many adult writers make when they try to write YA and don't succeed, which is that having a narrative that needs to work is not exclusive to important themes and to complexity and to emotional shades of gray. So I think the only real difference, and again, it's a difference that is a conversation. It's not a difference you can define. But I always say that the concerns of a teenage novel tend to be about testing your boundaries and finding out who you are and finding out the limits of yourself and crossing those limits and discovering it hurts or discovering that it's a new thing that you can be and are. And an adult novel tends to be, but again, only a tendency, to be about someone whose boundaries are already solidified. And the story tends to be about what happens when you're taken outside of those boundaries or how those boundaries have limited to you. And there I see zero qualitative difference between those two issues. Both are universal, both make for fantastic stories, intellectual ones, complex ones. And the concerns might be different, but it's not as simple as saying you have to be direct in one and indirect in another. That's a fallacy.
Let's go into some of the stories. Implied violence. I would describe it as a shaggy Rottweiler of a story. It involves a call centre and a caller. It's sort of quite Kafkaesque almost.
I think so. I mean, I think it's, if you've ever worked in a call centre, which I have, it was my very first jobs, there's just something soulless and awful about a call centre. And the way that the people in this call center are motivated to succeed is by this unnamed, unspecified threat down at the end of the hall. And that's kind of what being in a call center feels like. That's kind of what working in a call center feels like. And that's a story that comes back to one of my writing quirks, which is that whenever I start a novel, I always know the last line. because it's the dismount of the novel. The novel has to work on that last line. It has to be right or the book doesn't work.
Before you start writing
before it, Before I start writing it. Yeah, before I start writing the trilogy, I knew the last line of all three books. It's a quirk. I'm not saying that this is writing advice, but it's just what I do. And I knew the very last line of Implied Violence. I thought, that's it. That's perfect. Because that's what the story is about. The tension goes away from all of this horrible, you know, terror and implied violence. And they're just thrilled that they've reached their quota.
You're good on titles, aren't you? I like your titles. Jesus Elbows and Other Christian Urban Myths, yeah. Premised on the idea that God had to make Jesus double-jointed in order for him to be able to hang from the cross. How bizarre is that?
It began when somebody sent me a real urban legend, which I use, about a number of days allegedly missing from the sort of chemical calendar of the world that could be explained by the Bible. And I just thought, yeah, urban myths come from everywhere, come from any sect of society. And I was raised in a very religious family, so it's no terrible offense intended. And my very religious brother thought it was absolutely hilarious. I don't care to write very much autobiographically, except for, you know, The Gifted has some autobiographical elements, but I prefer to, you know, leave my family in private. They didn't ask to have a writer in the family, and, you know, they deserve protection. But I was raised in a religious family. Yeah, it comes out.
And you're also gay, raised in a religious family.
Yeah, which is a good place to be for a writer. Lots of material. You know, sitting on the edge, observing, feeling like an outsider. It's not the worst thing that can happen to a writer.
And you have taken that into your young adult fiction.
But I mean, more than this, you know, begins with a boy drowning. And he dies. On page three, he dies. And then he wakes up. And the question of, where is he? Is it the typical YA adventure answer? You know, is it the dystopian answer? Is it the world that can be explained by this great everything falling apart, which is, you know, what it feels like to be teenagers, why dystopias are so popular? But I wanted to take the metaphor of dystopia and push it and ask another question, you know? So the first part of the book asks, you know, where are we? What's happened? The second part of the book says, this is what happened. This is the YA adventure dystopia answer to what happened. And the third part of the book says, are you sure? And it becomes a question of, is this an afterlife? Could it be something different? And I think YA books can contain all that kind of complexity and intellectual challenge. And kids love it. Teenagers love it. They love being asked a question that they need to figure out themselves.
And just one last question, which is bringing us back to the story that Christopher just read, Now That You've Died. It does seem a different sort of writing form. And I was wondering whether you are going to develop in this direction. Are you going to write for the theatre more? Are you writing for films?
I reserve the right to write in any format because I think it's so important to stay challenged and stay fresh. So I've written the screenplay for Monster Calls, you know, which, fingers crossed, and it's gotten me other screenwriting work, which was a great surprise. And what a great challenge. And absolutely, I want to write for the stage. And absolutely, I want to keep writing teen novels and adult novels and short stories. I've written lots of short stories over the last, you know, 5 or 6 years, or a Doctor Who short story. You know, we can all link it all together. I think publishing a book is such a privilege. And the only really bad reviews I've ever written for your newspaper were ones where I thought the writer was being lazy, was taking the attention of a reader for granted. And that makes me so angry. It makes me so angry. It's such a privilege to be able to write a book that I feel like I have to keep myself challenged. I have to keep myself fresh and involved, because otherwise you calcify. And who wants to do that? Who wants to read that?
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.